Well, hello everyone. Thanks for downloading the podcast. Look, I mean, I usually do this every episode. The apologies coming for not having one for quite a while. Everyone's busy, everyone's got other things to do. But I am really, really happy that I am able to do another podcast episode today. And we do have a very good guest joining us to talk about some interesting stuff going on in quantum software development and just education in general in the quantum community. And it's Dr. Sarah Kaiser, who used to be here in Sydney, has moved back to the United States in Seattle, and now works for a consultancy firm called Pensar Developments. So, Sarah, thanks for giving me an hour of your time.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
So, as I usually do with these things, we first sort of start things off as a bit of a chat about you and how you got into quantum, and then sort of a bit about your background. If I'm not mistaken, you come mainly from the experimental side, is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct. In undergrad, everybody, you're taking your lab courses, you're taking your theory courses, and when I found out you could set things on fire with lasers, well, that's pretty much what I picked. So, yeah, most basically since undergrad, which was in Minnesota in the US, I've been working on a variety of different optoelectronics and photonics projects, working on kind of from an internship I had at Caltech. I started into it was quantum devices there. And kind of just thought at one point, I kind of had this realization that we could build things that could detect single photons. And that just kind of blew my mind and captured my attention ever since. So, yeah, in undergrad, I did some of the undergrad research fellowships to kind of narrow down exactly, what types of technologies I was interested in. Then, just to be sure, to see if I was interested in continuing in academia, I did a stint in industry working as a kernel developer for Wolfram Mathematica. So I actually worked on some of the like interactive GUI elements for that. Decided that a 9 to 5 was not for me. And yeah, then started my PhD in at the University of Waterloo at the Institute for Quantum Computing, where I worked on still more optics stuff, basically building and breaking quantum key distribution devices, which are kind of like a related spin-off technology of quantum computing. Yeah, and then after graduating, as you mentioned, did a postdoc at Macquarie University in Sydney, and now I am back in the States in Seattle working at Pensar Development.
So, would you have considered yourself a quantum computing person, or you more consider yourself just a sort of, well, just a quantum physicist, basically?
I would say I'm a quantum computing person. I've pretty much exclusively worked on like single photon optoelectronic systems, primarily as noted for the quantum communication stuff. But I guess it just seemed, quantum computing as a field kind of really seemed interesting to me because it's a whole new paradigm for how to do computing. Like, we pretty well understand classical computing at this point, and, kind of like many others, I suspect having just this something new unknown to go explore was really enticing.
And when you went back to Seattle, I mean, we're sort of going to lead into one of the reasons you're on the podcast today, and then this is about some of the work that you're doing with Microsoft in regards to their Q-Sharp platform and the software efforts that are going on there. So was that one of the main reasons why you decided to go back, or just a happy coincidence?
yeah, we it was partly a two-body problem, and
Yes.
partly Australia changing visa policies. So, but no, I'm pretty happy to be in Seattle. It's a pretty decent city as far as the US goes. And yeah, as you mentioned, I've been working on trying to develop some new educational materials for quantum computing because I kind of feel, or when I was studying felt and still now do feel that there's kind of a gap in terms of availability of material. You kind of get two ends of the spectrum. One, you have, well, all the graduate level texts and papers and stuff that, you know, most of us are familiar with from the research field. And then I use this in talks frequently, but my phone suggests to me all the time, all articles about, you might be interested in articles about quantum computing. And I'm like, thank you, phone. And as I'm sure you've seen, Simon, some of these articles have headlines that just make me kind of do a what?
Oh, they're getting better, aren't they?
I mean, some of them are definitely not as bad, but, you know, things about time travel and, you know, which very often all of them have, you know, some sort of kernel of truth to them. But, you know, if I was a lay reader who, you know, was just generally interested in kind of this, what is this quantum computing thing? I feel like it would be pretty confusing to try and read some of those articles and, you know, even just try to come to some concrete understanding of what is actually going on.
Yeah, there's been a couple of doozies just in the last 10 days, actually.
I have a slide that I usually start most of my talks with where I just have screen capped all of these on my phone and I hide one that's actually like reasonable in the middle.
I think I want a copy of that slide if you're willing to give it up.
Certainly. But yeah, so kind of what that led to was because especially when I moved here to Seattle, I started going to a lot of meetups because that's coding meetups, Pi Ladies, Seattle Coffee Ops, things like that, just to kind of get to know some people in the area. Mm-hmm. And, you know, everybody was always really interested about quantum computing. They're like, oh, that's so cool, but I know nothing about it.
Right.
And so, yeah, I just kind of felt that, you know, A, I clearly have too much free time, and B, really, especially from grad school, I did do a lot of outreach while at IQC, building museum exhibits, hosting summer schools, writing lectures, things like that. And it's something that I, you know, helping people understand, you know, cutting edge technology is just very satisfying to me. Like, you can explain it to another researcher and that's also exciting, but, you know, especially when it's an audience that, you know, doesn't have the sort of normal usual contact with, mm-hmm. you know, what is literally the bleeding edge. It's really fun.
So, I mean, yeah, I mean, this book is one of the reasons you're on today. This Learn Quantum Computing with Python and Q#. And actually, your publisher was nice enough to give us some promo codes that we'll link in the description of this podcast. For everyone who downloads it, if you want a discount to go buy it and take a read, certainly grab the promo code off this episode and use it to get a copy. But looking through it, although the title is, you know, Learning Quantum Computing with Python and Q#, there seems to be a large part that's also just basic introductory text to what qubits are, what standard quantum protocols like teleportation and quantum key distribution is, before you necessarily even get into the sort of the nitty gritty of quantum programming. I assume that was intentional.
Oh yeah. You know, it's kind of hard to just, we wanted to kind of set the audience or expectations for folks that read this book. We're kind of assuming we're talking to perhaps a professional programmer, but with or kind of first or second year undergrad student who has done some like math, is comfortable with multiplying matrices, you know, mm-hmm. kind of very basic linear algebra. But really, that's about it. And, you know, has some familiarity in some programming language. I actually don't even really care which one, but, you know, the concept of writing a function, variables, etc. Mm-hmm. Certainly, so the two languages mentioned in the title, Python and Q#, we kind of went with Python because that is a more common kind of baseline familiar language for folks, and is being used increasingly more in educational contexts. So, you know, hopefully they might have seen stuff in Python before, but even if not, we kind of go through all of that. But we use Python as a tool to, as you mentioned, kind of go from the very basics of building up what is a bit to what is a qubit, talking about, you know, and kind of doing this step-by-step comparison of things that we're familiar with, like operations we have on a classical computer, like ands, ors, nots, and what does that look like in the quantum computing context? Mm-hmm. And it's kind of slowly working our way up to using, you know, after we've kind of, you actually get to build your own simulator for a quantum computer in Python. And so once we get finished with that, then we can kind of hop over into the domain-specific programming language for quantum computers, Q#. And so, you know, kind of now understanding a bit more of what's going on under the hood there, we can start building up to more complex algorithms and start trying to see how these effects we learned about with kind of Python and stepping through the math and stuff like that actually give us some of these advantages in quantum programming.
So basically the first, half of the book is you don't need to necessarily be downloading Q#. You don't need to look at the Microsoft forums just yet. We're going to get you all started just on the bare basics and then move mm-hmm. on to something like Q# to start doing the more complex stuff.
Yeah. So, and we, yeah. Sorry, go ahead.
No, keep going.
We selected Q# for the second stage, partly as I mentioned, because it is a domain specific, it is an entirely new programming language. Mm-hmm. It is based on .NET, so it does kind of mesh nicely with other .NET languages like C#, and a lot of the backend for it is actually written in C#, but it is actually a new language, which kind of gives it an interesting. It's designed in such a way that you can actually think at the algorithmic level about your quantum program, and you're thinking about the quantum algorithm, not like implementation details necessarily of, you know, whatever other language you're using to implement it.
So, I mean, the book itself, it's not quite fully published yet. Is that correct? It's in this, what they call MEAP stage, this Manning Early Access Program.
That's right.
Looking at the website right now, it's saying it's scheduled in the spring of 2020. So there's still a little bit more work to do.
we're a little over halfway done now. There's I think two or three chapters up in this what Manning calls MEAP. It's kind of like a beta, if you will. Mm-hmm. And kind of one of the neat parts about it is people who buy the book in MEAP, they get a discount, but also get to help provide feedback to us as the authors. There's like forums and stuff like that, so you can help us, you know, kind of create a better text that actually, you know, so if there's things that aren't clear or things that you want to know more about, it's kind of we've already gotten quite a few comments on the forums and been responding with them. At first I was a little skeptical because I'm not sure like a priori I would have bought a book like this, but at least being on the author side of it, it is really fun to get that engagement kind of as you're writing. So it's not just like this, you know, 2-year long conversation with your publisher and then, oh, hey, it's out there and now you can't change things.
Yeah, I was just about to ask about what kind of feedback you've had so far from both the quantum community and the non-classical software engineering community.
It's been pretty good so far. We did, for what is currently out, went through Manning's kind of review process where they found a bunch of relevant experts in a variety of just classical programming expertise. And as you might expect, it was more difficult for them to find people who did quantum programming more regularly. But given that myself and Chris, my co-author, are in the field, we found suggested some people who could help provide feedback. I think it's been going over pretty well so far. And I'm really looking forward to getting more of it out there. So.
Well, it's one of the things I was interested to pick your brain about, because certainly before all of this cropped up with, you know, Microsoft's approach with Q Sharp, IBM Qiskit, Circ with Google, and these other things, there was sort of an idea around for quantum algorithm development and quantum programming that, look, if we start getting these things into the classical software engineering world and we train people and educate people in the right way, they're the better people to be finding these killer applications for quantum computers than, say, the physics community or the research community. We've sort of been in this space now for a couple of years. I mean, Microsoft started its efforts on what became Q Sharp quite a few years ago, same with IBM, same with Google. From your estimate, from what you've seen being involved with the Q Sharp community and getting your feet wet in this field, how do you see this approach for engagement? Do you see that people are getting interested, or do you see more that, oh yeah, I like quantum, I'll participate with you for a day or a day and a half on a hackathon. Oh yeah, it sounds interesting, but I've got better things to do. What's your feeling on this approach? Do you think it's the right way to go about it, or do you think the data's come in to a certain extent to say, well, maybe we have to rethink this if we want to engage the community effectively?
Yeah, I think that's a really good and really fair question. And I guess the short answer would be I do think it is important to engage communities outside of the kind of physics, chemistry, or yeah, physics, material science, and CS that's kind of already involved in the actual hardware and software development. Primarily because I do genuinely don't, I genuinely think that it will be people coming from outside of our community that will kind of provide that new perspective, provide just kind of knowledge of whole different problem sets that we have not thought about yet that will kind of stimulate this discussion. Like, it's like when you do brainstorming, there's no bad ideas, and the more ideas you have, statistically speaking, you'll probably arrive at a better answer in the end, or a better idea to work from. And sorry, go ahead.
So I suppose it was more so in regards to what are you seeing from the non-quantum community? So this approach of having frameworks like Q Sharp, hackathons, you know, the way that the quantum community is trying to approach this other community, do you get a feeling like it's being effective? Or do you feel like, again, you know, they think it's interesting, but I can't do much on a quantum computer. This stuff like superposition entanglement still confuses the hell out of me, and I don't seem to be getting it any better. And so, sure, I'll spend an afternoon playing with it, but I'm not going to devote 8 hours a day for a couple of weeks to try and develop new applications.
Yeah, I mean, I think right now a lot of the efforts, it's kind of a mixed bag. What really does make efforts like that successful are making sure that like the activities, the hackathon, the kind of the material is geared for the audience that's actually attending. And I think this is sometimes really challenging to do, especially when we are used to, you know, working with our colleagues in the field where we're just, you know, using bracket notation like no problem. Using it's been one of the kind of evergreen feedback we get from our editor on the book, which is, you know, think about what technical terms you want to use, like is it really critical to define and use this here, or you know, can we hold off and do things just in time so as not to kind of overload people with a bunch of information at the beginning. And so yeah, I think when I have seen instances of these sorts of efforts to kind of reach out to the broader community going well and sometimes going not so well. Which, you know, sometimes is no fault of the actual presenter or organizer, you know. But yeah, I breaking one of the, I would say the mission statement that Chris and I always return to of why we're working on this book is we want to break down some of the barriers that prevent people from getting into quantum computing.
Right.
We want to make it accessible because, I mean, in reality, we're mostly just doing linear algebra. I mean, quantum computing is linear, asterisk measurement, but, you know, that is a concept that is actually quite prevalent in classical computing, like graphics, you know, it is a pretty fundamental piece of what we already understand. And I feel like making that, like using that as kind of the starting point and saying, look how much we have in common, as opposed to saying, look at all these weird things and it's so different and it's so strange. And yeah, like also how you set the tone for the content that you have in these events, outreach sort of things, I think can also have a huge impact on how it will be received as well.
Well, I mean, the Microsoft Q Sharp and the software development part of Microsoft has decided to go open source recently on this. Mm-hmm. And when you've been interacting with the Microsoft community, do you see the open sourcing of this, whether it's Q Sharp, whether it's Qiskit or the other ones, as being an effective approach, or are you predominantly seeing, you know, the most active users being effectively quantum people who have potentially other reasons as to why they get into this? You know, they have their own particular hobby horses in regards to quantum algorithm development or stuff like that. Or are we seeing with the open sourcing of this technology that it's not very spiked at just the colleagues that we would know the names for? We're actually seeing a large swath of people from a large swath of industries come in, or interests, I should say, rather than industries.
Right. Good question. I think I'll speak to first my experience with the Q-Sharp community, which is, I think, a fair bit of the people that I see, like, making pull requests and, you know, adding content and stuff like that, actually aren't necessarily from the quantum community, mm-hmm. And actually are some of the, like, more engaged parts of the community as well. I'll put out there as well that, so in addition to all of the Microsoft open source stuff, I've actually helped start with some of these non-quantum community folks, mm-hmm. a new GitHub org called Q-Sharp dash community. Our URL is qsharp.community. But the idea is that a lot of open source projects have kind of community or contributed components, which aren't officially maintained, but are locations where you can kind of collect projects, blogs, tutorials, things like that, as a good starting point for someone who says, hey, I'm interested in this, I want to start a project, what might that look like? Mm-hmm. You know, that's not an official tutorial or something like that. So it's, in addition to the book, something else that I'm really excited about, because I think, to come back to the question you were asking, kind of more around what is the interplay between open source and community, and what the community looks like for these quantum programming projects. I think it's definitely a good thing to open source. I strongly believe in open and reproducible science. But making something open source isn't necessarily enough. Like, what actually will make the project successful and kind of long lasting, mm-hmm. Which especially is important in the case of quantum computing, because we know it's going to take a while for us to get, you know, hardware online that is kind of a scale. Well, we have near-term devices, but, you know, especially with the long-term visions out there that people are interested in, we have some time.
Yes,
and so, and what that means is it really is important for us to kind of build up that momentum and build up those communities that especially extend past just the academic researchers on the topic. And I've seen it now in a number of different contexts, from even just like the coding meetups that I go to here in Seattle, to groups that I helped start in Waterloo. Like, community is really surprisingly one of the most powerful things in science.
So when you start up these sort of collaborations or these community projects, so one of the things I'm interested in is how do you see retention? Like, again, how it's hard to put a percentage on it, or but maybe a gut feeling would be, you know, how many people come in and engage with you or engage with the group, but then disappear very quickly, versus the people who hang around and really, you know, get into it in a pretty significant way?
So that's a good question. Given that the Q-Sharp community stuff is not even a month old yet, I don't think I have sufficient data to to comment on yet. Yeah. But thinking more historically about some of the other community efforts that I've been involved in, so one in particular was called FemPhys, and it was kind of a group for women in quantum computing and applied physics and math more generally at UW, or at University of Waterloo. And it has grown almost 4 times larger than when we started it. And we had probably about 40 or 50 people when we started. So it's been, it's been really exciting. And I think what is key about keeping that, because I agree, it is definitely a phenomenon I see with the quantum computing stuff. People see it, they'll come to a talk or whatever, they're interested, they'll do a thing, and then they disappear. And, you know, in some ways, I'm almost okay with that, because as long as that's kind of just there in the back of their mind, that they know it exists, or even if the only thing that they got out of those interactions is they have perhaps a slightly more realistic view of what quantum computing is, and importantly, what it's capable of. you know, I guess from my perspective, I'd view that as a win, but that doesn't necessarily address the how do you keep it going long term. And I really think making, you know, having the community be focused on open source, having good codes of conduct, to make people actually feel welcome and safe in these communities, and, you know, being active and engaging them as organizers. You know, I have like 40 different ideas for blog posts that I want to write, and, you know, people, I've given talks at, I spoke at Microsoft Build this year and at a couple of machine learning conferences, and have actually gotten some really interesting, like, collaboration ideas for from folks that knew nothing about quantum computing before, you know, going to the talks and checking out, you know, like Q-Sharp online. And
that anything just, you want to share, or are you just going to hold it close to your chest for the time being?
Oh, I'm sure I will be posting about it soon.
I don't want to steal your thunder.
No. It's partly just, it's time. I work a full-time job. Right now, our Chris and my primary focus is trying to get the book finished, so that we can then kind of expand on that and start working on kind of the stuff that feeds into that. Because especially about it. So a year ago, when we moved to Seattle, I did not know what Microsoft Build was. I had worked as a dev before, but I guess I didn't really see myself as one. You know, I'm an experimentalist. Which, you know, you do a surprising amount of coding for, but that wasn't like kind of a label I self-identified with. And I ended up going to one of these meetups. I won a free ticket to go to Build. And so last year I went to Build, met so many really interested people that were like, what do you do or what do you know about? And I tell them about quantum computing and stuff. And they're like, great, what's a good book for me to look at? And, you know, there's some good ones. I think Riffle comes to mind, mm-hmm. A Gentle Introduction, and a few others that I, you know, started giving out. But a lot of them were, you know, long-term classical devs that were like, but I want something for me.
Yeah. Although speaking of sort of slow introductions, I mean, I suppose that segues into the next topic quite interestingly, because we've had him on the podcast before, Chris Ferry, who's noted for being the author of the Baby University series. But recently, mm-hmm. you've been working on a few of his books as well. You and him are now co-authors on three, correct me if I'm wrong, the Robotics for Babies, the Neural Networks for Babies, and the ABCs of Engineering. Are they the mm-hmm. Only three so far with Chris?
So far, yeah. We have some plans for other things, but mm-hmm. When Chris approached me about those, I was super excited. I do a lot of automation and robotics and actually machine learning now at my current job. And so, you know, kind of those topics really kind of made sense. And, you know, I just had a blast working on those, especially the ABCs of engineering.
Yeah. So, I mean, what has the experience been? Because obviously this whole niche of books that Chris has been working on has kind of blown up. People have become very enamored with them. But mm-hmm. from your perspective of I assumed, you know, the topics were essentially yours and you and Chris worked together to put it together into sort of his format. Mm-hmm. But considering he started off with, you know, quantum physics for babies and now he's into robotics and neural networks and all of that, it must have been quite an interesting experience for you to put it all out there and then see the response that you're getting for it.
Yeah, all of the people who I've talked to about these have just, I mean, I loved making them, and I think people really can see that they were made by someone who is an engineer in mm-hmm. in those disciplines, who's done those things. I think my favorite example of this is in the ABCs one, R is for requirements, which initially my publisher was like, that doesn't sound like an engineering thing, you know, do something else like robot. And I was like, no. Requirements are critical. All engineering projects are going to have requirements. They're going to have a statement of work, you know, things like that. But, and like the graphic for that page even is the requirements we had for the book, the ABC awesome. Book itself. So of course, we had to be a bit meta, but, yeah, like I love sharing those with other engineering folks. I just was at a wedding this weekend and I saw they're actually the Hudson bookstores in most airport terminals now carry ABCs of engineering.
Yeah, I've seen you sneakily been signing them at airport bookstores all over the place. So, I mean, what way this SeaTac could probably have some for people who want to quickly rush over. And where did you say?
I was in Santa Fe, so I also found some there. But
people can rush there. There might be some still signed copies lying on the bookshelf.
Yeah, I even when it first came out, I was so excited about it. We had a laser cutter at work, and so I started. I did a giveaway where I did some laser signed copies. Because I mean, clearly, if I'm an engineer and I have a laser cutter, what else am I going to do? And I need to sign things. Like, Sharpie, amateur hour.
Yeah, I mean, you really have to embrace it all or embrace none of it.
Exactly. But, yeah, in reality, what I think I get makes me most excited about this is it really helps... How best to put this? It really makes these cutting, again, kind of cutting edge science, STEM sort of topics accessible, and makes them, you know, common isn't exactly the right phrase here, but, you know, if people are talking about them, then perhaps they're a little less scary, you know, if it isn't just this like, ooh, pie in the sky sort of thing, or that's only, you know, that's for smart people or something silly like that. A great example of this that happened one time, I was with Chris Ferry. He was doing a book reading at a bookstore. I think he was in fact reading from Goodnight Lab, but he stopped on a page and like one of the things you say goodnight to is the spectrometer. And, you know, that's generally not a word that's in common parlance. But, you know, he stopped on the page and was like, can anybody find the spectrometer? And this little, I would estimate probably 3 or 4 year old girl was like, I found it. Spectrometer. You know, she kind of struggled at first, but then she actually said the word spectrometer. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that, I mean, I was almost crying, but that just kind of really kind of impacted me because, you know, having kids not be afraid of kind of these kind of more sciencey topics, just making it a comment, you know, just like they talk about being an astronaut or being a you know, princess or or whatever, you know, they understand the scope of what that means. I feel like if they can understand better the scope of what it means to be a scientist, what it means to be a programmer, what it means to be, you know, a roboticist, then, you know, that will help, especially with girls and other underrepresented groups in STEM.
I mean, have you been I mean, I know Chris does a lot of book readings and travels around to promote the series. Have you been doing any on your own since you, with the three books you've done so far?
I've been doing a bit, yeah. There's, we're actually doing one this Saturday together because Chris Ferry's in town, which is awesome. But yeah, no, there's tons of really neat bookstores in Seattle that summertime is kind of apparently popular for this because kids are out of school and they need parents want you know, kind of an activity to go do. So I have a number of different kind of book readings, and I usually try to bring some demos or activities to do with as well, which I think my favorite is having them write requirements for a project.
I thought you'd just be popping balloons with a laser.
I wish laser cutters were more portable, honestly. Like, I would have a backpack laser cutter.
Yeah, I think we all would.
Yeah.
And you see an whole different type of street crime going on.
Yeah, graffiti and vandalism might have an entirely different
I'd be okay look. With that.
Yeah, I mean, I'm down for anything with a laser.
Yeah, I think anyone is. So, I mean, moving on, one of the other things I wanted to talk about with you is just your, you know, some current opinions on the field, whether it's hardware, software, education, policy, within the quantum space, either in the US where you are now and where you were, Canada, Australia, anywhere where you've got, you know, some insight into where things are going and what you think about where things are going in contrast to maybe where you think they should be going.
Yeah, that's a good question. I think something that I've kind of observed over the last couple of years is, I mean, as many of us have, is seeing the increased industry involvement in this field. And while that's exciting and very important, it almost seems like we've shifted now to what one might normally expect of academia being kind of cutting edge and industry doing more of the kind of safe, just build on the engineering practices sort of things. It seems like it's getting harder and harder for academic groups to actually kind of lead the pack on that sort of stuff, because of, grant pressures because of paper. Like, you know, one of the things I disliked the most about being in academia was, you know, this constant pressure to publish, and especially when that meant compromising, you know, how I wanted to do the science. Like, if I didn't have time to open source things, or, you know, it doesn't mean all of that constant pressure means we're not getting the best science we can done. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And, you know, a lot of that comes from funding concerns. Like, you know, it's nobody's fault, but it just seems like we've seen this kind of shift of the incentive structures kind of weirdly moving the mark, such that the folks that have kind of like the most, freedom isn't exactly the right word, but the most space to get good work done is not necessarily in academia anymore. Not exclusively, but, you know, I just think about how much paperwork Chris Ferry has to do as a part of his professor job. Like, he, even that alone leaves him so little time to then write the grants, to get the time, to get the money, to do the research. And, you know, it really makes me sad that that doesn't feel like that's the way it should be. And, you know, where I do like that a lot of the industry has been going towards open source software. I think that obviously is very important, and will help in building up, you know, this new workforce of quantum programming professionals in the future. We've seen so many examples from classical programming of kind of what happens when you open source things, how much more that engages people. I really do. I am excited about that, and excited to see how kind of all the different efforts choose to proceed, if you will.
Well, I mean, it's the other part that that you're also fairly active in. I mean, there's the way science is done in the academic space, and the way it's done now within the emerging sort of startup and industry space on quantum. But you're also quite active in areas of research ethics, scientific ethics, issues around inclusivity and diversity and stuff like that. And certainly I'd like to get your thoughts on what's going on in that space as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, in addition to what we kind of just mentioned about the incentive structures, just in general, I mean, one of the reasons I really didn't want to be in academia anymore was because the environment itself was just so horrible. I think, especially if we want this field to continue, we really need to take a long, hard look about what matters to us. Mm-hmm. You know, is actually getting to do the science more important than, you know, a citation or something like that? Or, you know, even just treating our co-workers and co-authors and collaborators as humans and not just, you know, students as machines that turn out tech files for people to review. I feel like it is, you know, at almost crisis levels of we really need to take some time to do some introspection to address how we, I mean, even just consider who people in the general, like if you ask someone off the street, you know, can you name a physicist, or can you name a quantum physicist even, perhaps, who are the examples, and, you know, what did they do and what did they normalize about the field? Feynman is probably one of the most popular, we'll go with fathers of the field, but, you know, he regularly held group meetings at strip clubs. And that just, you know, when we hold up and we kind of hero worship all of these people, which, yes, their work was important, it serves as the basis for what we're working on now, but that glorifying the actual research somehow kind of enshrines these expectations and behaviors that really are not going to work if moving forward if we actually want people to stay in the field.
Well, I mean, there's certainly the public side of, you know, the people that are represented to sort of the outside world in regards to this stuff, and Feynman's an example you bring up. But then you've also said just prior to that, there's also to what happens internally in regards
absolutely.
To what people's experiences are, you know, whether they're students, postdocs, junior level academics. But in terms of things that you've seen around the world, in terms of people trying to address this in one form or another, is there any good templates that you see that are out there, or do you really think everything's got to go back to the drawing board?
I mean, I think there definitely are some, you know, good first steps. Even different professional societies have published some good kind of like white papers on ways you can, because a lot of it comes down to, especially if we're talking about academic institutions, what is kind of baked into how the university operates. So things like codes of conduct for institutes or events or conferences, like, they are absolutely critical. Like, I will refuse to go to an event that does not have a code of conduct, because too many times I've done so, had issues of, you know, people touching me or trying to tell me I don't belong there, and, you know, having no, they provide a framework for a discussion about it. It's not, I mean, their purpose is not to punish people or to, you know, say what you can and can't do. It's just to set, you know, what is kind of the lowest bar for reasonable expectations of how you behave as a human being. and, you know, I really appreciate that a lot of big companies now are actually making it policy that they won't send employees to conferences, events, whatever, that don't have codes of conduct.
So they are becoming more prevalent?
I think so, yeah. I mean, I've been to a few Microsoft events, and I've always been really impressed that, you know, the first like big banner you see other than the literal name of the event is, here's the code of conduct. And, you know, when you register, you have to tick that you've read it and agree and things like that. And while I'm sure most people don't actually read that, it's important to have there, because it also describes like what the procedure, not only what behavior is expected at the event, but what are the procedures that and what gets triggered when people are not necessarily behaving as they should. And, you know, as someone who's had to report things like that before, being able to just read somewhere what's going to happen is really empowering, to know that, like, all right, I can be in control of this process. And, you know, this isn't just me. Everywhere I've worked in academia, from undergrad to grad school to postdocs, almost all of the time when I sit down and I talk with other women in the department, if there are any, and we find out that, and other underrepresented groups in the department, this happens everywhere. It, you know, I'm sure a lot of people's responses to this is, oh no, but my team, you know, we're all happy together. No, assume it is happening everywhere. And what, you know, what we should take from that is, let's be proactive about trying to address this instead of just waiting for something, you know, worse to happen and then trying to figure out where to go from there. And things like codes of conduct, looking at hiring practices, looking at support for students, you know, whether that's just, and a lot of these policies benefit all, like, just make things better for everyone. So it's not like they're just specifically targeting a specific group. Like, one, a, a fairly important one that I struggled with in grad school was reimbursement policies. Many universities don't actually won't pay for stuff up front. So you have to like pay for your own travel, pay for your own, like if you go to conference registration fees, you know, either you convince your supervisor to give you their credit card or you have to pay for that yourself. And, you know, as a student, you often don't have that kind of credit and you end up having to pay credit card fees and stuff like that, that are not covered by the university. And that just really sucks because, you know, generally students are making roughly minimum wage already to start with. And yeah, so just kind of doing an ethical review of the, of all the policies and procedures surrounding, you know, how faculty interact with students, how students interact with faculty and staff, how the university, handles conflict and escalation, you know, making sure people even know that stuff exists. You know, you could have the best policies in the world, but if nobody actually knows that they're there, then that doesn't help. So,
I mean, do you see things moving in the right direction or
no?
Things are just stagnant or going backwards?
Yes. There are, you know, perhaps specific efforts that are doing better. You know, it's not quantum computing, but I could point to what happened in the astrophysics community a couple years ago when there was a couple big headline cases that broke, I believe at Caltech and Stanford, maybe, where it was, you know, fairly prominent researchers in the field. Universities wouldn't do anything and didn't do anything for years. And then basically groups of people came forward in public, described what had been happening. And then the university was kind of forced to action. And since then, what's happened is a lot of the professional societies have kind of stepped up to say, hey, look, you know, we're going to try and help advocate for our members, advocate for our community, try to, you know, help universities transform their processes and actually do that introspection to try and make their institutions and campuses safe places for everybody to do research. And I guess I am just, I fear what could happen to quantum computing if, you know, something similar has to happen to get people to start doing that process.
Right.
And, you know, I feel like it would be much better if we just start thinking about this now and, you know, trying to retain all of the amazing researchers that are already in the field and are doing that great work.
Right. So we're coming up on an hour now. So I suppose that's usually how long I try and keep these things. So just as a last thing, is there anything upcoming, anything interesting that's going on with you and your work that you'd like to put in a plug for or advertise for to let people know what's happening?
Well, the book is one obvious one. Check it out at Manning. Definitely check out the discount code from the podcast description here. And also check out qsharp.community. As I mentioned, it's a fairly new effort, so we're still building it up, but we have a Gitter. And just come chat, ask a question. I'm have so many plans for what I want to kind of add to it, kind of like lists of project ideas, providing some tutorial and content stuff not in English. So kind of trying to broaden the community in that respect by having blog posts and tutorials written in other languages. Yeah, like just come hang out, ask questions about Q Sharp or really anything related to quantum computing.
Wonderful. So, yeah. No, that's great. I'll put all the links to that in the description for this and obviously in our Twitter feeds and all our other social media posts. I'll link to your Twitter feeds and your social media posts so people can come and bug you on that if they want to ask about what's going on with Q Sharp or the book or the baby university stuff or any of the wonderful things that you've got running at the moment.
Yeah, and also hit me up on Twitter. I'm definitely an active Twitter user at crazy four, the number four, PI314.
I'll make sure that that's linked.
Cool.
I don't know.
Awesome.
Can't people just have Twitter names like, I don't know, Sarah?
That was my first internet username from back in the AIM days, and I'm sticking
Fair
to
enough
it.
then. Well, anyway, Sarah, thanks very, very much for spending an hour of your evening over there to talk about what's going on in your neck of the woods.
Yeah, no, it's always really fun. I love listening to the podcast, and it's a good way to kind of keep up to date on what's actually going on.
Yes, and I keep saying I'll try to have more regular episodes, but you know, things are the way things are. I wish I could be more disciplined, but I'm not. So anyway,
Yeah,
Sarah, thanks again for your time.
thank you so much.
Cheers.